Well, good afternoon and welcome. We're very glad to see you all here. My name is Paul Fields, and I'm the librarian who works in the H. Henry Meter Center, who is sponsoring this lecture. We're very glad to see you. I am going to introduce our speaker today. Corinne Maugg is well known to many of us. She's taught here for 15 years in the history department. She is the director of the Meter Center. And she's known very well in the call classes. In fact, in the Meter Center, we call her the call queen. And we today have many of you here as an example of that. Corinne was born and brought up in Canada, did her undergraduate studies in Montreal, and her graduate work at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. She is the author of a well-regarded monograph on the history of higher education in Reformation Geneva, has edited several volumes of essays, translated 3 books, and written numerous articles and book chapters. Her current research projects include the preparation of a volume of primary sources on worship in Reformation Geneva and a critical edition of Calvin's Second Catechism. Today, her presentation is entitled Text in Context, the 450th Anniversary of the Belgic Confession. So please join me in welcoming Corinne Maugg.
Thank you, Paul, for that introduction, and thank you all for coming today. It's nice to see everybody here. Today's presentation on the Belgic Confession is to mark its 450th anniversary, because the first edition of the Belgic Confession is back in 1561. Now, just so this is interesting to everyone, and because I have a lot of my call people here, this will not proceed as a straight lecture. There will be times when I will ask you for your feedback, and you will get to give your ideas. So don't be shy. Speak up whenever you want to interject something and make a point that is connected to what I'm saying. So, in the next 45 minutes or so, I will be presenting the all-important historical context to the Belgic Confession to mark its 450th anniversary. The Confession was first published in French in 1561. So if you're thinking important things to know about, the first language in which the Belgic Confession was written was French. If you happen to think it might have been Dutch or English or something like that, no, it was first written in French. Now, it was adopted as a normative statement of faith eventually by the Synod of Dort in 1619, and from then on it served really as a normative confession, becoming one of the 3 doctrinal standards of the CRC. What I'm going to do today is present the historical context of the Belgic Confession, just so you get a better sense of the history of that particular text, but also to open up a conversation about the nature of confessional texts. What is their purpose? What is their authority? And what do we do with these texts, which are human origin, right? They're written by human beings, and yet they carry a lot of weight, a lot of authority. So I want to talk and unpack with you a little bit about what does it mean to have a confessional text, and what purpose do these texts serve. We can also discuss the status of other texts. I know some people are interested in discussing the Belhar Confession, and we can come up to that in the discussion session at the end. So, understanding the context. Well, understanding the context is vital. I think there are a number of people here who were in my call class this fall. I was doing a call class, the Calvin Academy for Lifelong Learning. I was doing a class on heresy and heterodoxy in the early church. And we talked a lot about the creeds at that point. We talked about the Nicene Creed, and we talked about the Athanasian Creed. And what we discovered was you had to know a lot about the history in order to make sense of these creeds, why they were written, why they're so focused on the dual nature of Christ. You know, you had to understand the historical context. The same is true when we talk about the Belgic Confession. These texts come from a specific time and a specific place. So, a starting point. For a starting point, we need to know what was going on in the Low Countries in 1561. So here's the historical context of the Belgic Confession. So the historical context of the Belgic Confession, and let's see if I can make this work. And maybe not. As usual. Okay. White on white. All right. Historical context. Here we go. A lovely map. Now, this map is a map of the Low Countries. When we talk about the Low Countries in the 16th century, we're talking about a different land mass than the Netherlands today. So what we're talking about, the Low Countries, encompasses part of northern France. It encompasses what today is Belgium. It encompasses the Netherlands. It's a much larger territory than what we talk about when we talk about the Netherlands today. In the north of the Low Countries, people spoke Dutch. In the south, they spoke French. But it was all one territory, made up in the 1560s of 17 different provinces. And in these 17 different provinces, the overall confession, officially, was Catholicism in the 1560s. The overall ruler of the Low Countries up until the late 1550s was Charles V, and then succeeded by his son, Philip II. And here are those two men. You recognize the Habsburg chin, okay? Charles V and Philip II. Now, when Philip II came to power, when he took over from his father in the late 1550s, he moved fairly swiftly to Spain. And he couldn't run the Netherlands from Spain very easily, so he appointed a governor. The governor was his half-sister, Margaret of Parma. There's Margaret of Parma, governor of the Low Countries from 1559 to 1567. Now, the Inquisition was active in the Low Countries beginning in 1523. This was a Catholic country, and the rulers, Charles V, Philip II, and Margaret of Parma, wanted to keep the land Catholic. But the ideas of the Reformation were taking root, first in the Lutheran form, then in an Anabaptist phase, and finally in a Calvinist phase. So you get a sort of a succession of different groups wanting major religious change. And this was obviously very problematic for the Catholic authorities, who didn't want that, and who saw really Catholicism as one of the grounds of unity of the Low Countries. So we want to keep the Low Countries Catholic. In order to do so, they brought in the Inquisition, beginning in 1523, and there were a lot of executions for religious reasons. Of all the places in Europe at the time, from the period from 1523 to 1566, there were over 1,300 people executed. And that was the highest rate and number across Europe. I mean, this is a very high rate of people executed for their faith in this period. In the period of about 40 years, 1,300 people were executed for their faith. So it's a very traumatic period. As you can imagine, if you're living through this is the deeply traumatic experience. Now, if you were Reformed and if you were living in the Low Countries at the time, it could be very dangerous, and therefore one option would be to go into exile. Any guesses or suggestions as to where you would go if you were Reformed living in the Low Countries? Where would you like to head for?
Michigan.
Michigan could be a little difficult at this time. Don't think we'll try that. Try something a little closer. Geneva. Geneva is a very good option, as particularly if you're French-speaking. There's a nice linguistic thing. So some people went to Geneva. Some people actually went across the English Channel to England, especially under Edward VI. Edward VI, the first child of the first son to succeed, Henry VIII, and under his reign from 1547 to 53, England was Protestant. So that was a good option. You could go to England, you could go to Geneva. Some people went to France in the intermissions between the various phases of the French Civil Wars. Some people just hopped over the border into East Friesland, the very north. Now you're into German territory, but it was also hospitable to the Reformed. So there were options. You could go into exile. By 1561, when the Belgic Confession was first published, things were very tense. The Reformed Protestants were experiencing persecution, and even within the movement, there was division. So let's think about this. Really, there are two factions within Reformed Protestants at the time, a more moderate faction and a more hardline faction. So if you're in the moderate faction, what you want to do is spread the Reformed faith quietly. Okay? You want to give pastoral care to the people who already Reformed, and you want to keep kind of your heads down, okay? Spread the movement quietly, person to person, have secret meetings of the believers, maybe set up some kind of structures, but just grow quietly. Now, if you were more hardline and you wanted to really assert the importance of the Reformed faith, what would you do differently than the moderates might? What would be some of your tactics? You want to make really a sign to say the Reformed faith is important, it's here, it's vital. What would you want to do? Okay, well, write a confession. In fact, that was a moderate suggestion rather than the hardliner ones. Hardliners tended to prefer things like preaching in public. That's a nice big statement. Singing the Psalms in public. Now, that's a nice statement. And the other one they were very understandably quite keen on was to rescue prisoners. Okay, so someone or other's been captured and they're going to be executed for their faith. Well, the hardliners and the Reformed say what we need to do is do prison breaks. And we need to essentially grab them when they're on the road to execution and save them from being executed. Now, all of these things, public preaching, public psalm singing, rescuing prisoners, in some ways, these were very concerning to the authorities because it suggested a disruption of civil order. Right? It suggested a breakdown of the order of society. And the Catholic authorities were not keen on this. So you find the sort of moderates telling the hardliners, you know, slow down, simmer down, don't keep doing these things. Because the more you do this, well, the more the authorities know we're here, and the more they come and arrest us and put us in jail and execute us, and that's the end of our movement. So two very different factions, two very different approaches. Now, this is important. Because the writing of the Belgic Confession happened within this tension between the more moderates and the more hardliners. And Guy Debray, he's on your sheet, Guy Debray is the man who authored the Belgic Confession, and he was a moderate. So his aim was to reassure the authorities and tell the authorities, really, truly, we are not rebels, we're not dangerous people, we're not disruptors of the civil order, and here are our beliefs. So the writing of the confession happened within this tension within the Reformed faith about how do you behave in times of persecution, which is an ongoing problem. Those who've done early church history, you know, it's exactly the same thing. How do you behave when the Roman authorities come to town and are looking for Christians? Do you stand up and wave and say, here I am, come and get me? Or do you kind of live a little more concealed? So what you find is Guy Debray and his confession of faith was intended to make the argument on one side of these two groups within the Reformed faith at the time. He was trying to mitigate the impact of the more radical actions of some of his colleagues. And he wanted to give the Catholics a better sense of who the Reformed were. What better way to do it than to write a confession? So, now some background on Guy Debray himself. Now, I can't give you an image of Guy Debray because there is no image of him. Again, he lived a concealed life. He lived much of his life not using his real name. He pastored a church that was using a sort of an alias. He went into exile several times, so there's no reproduction of what he actually looked like. He was born in 1522. He trained as a stained glass painter, so his background was that of a craftsman. In the 1540s, probably around 1547, he adopted the Reformed faith, so as a relatively young man, and he quickly became a leader in his home area, which was in the southern part of the Low Countries, in the French-speaking part in what is today Belgium. He was a man who took leadership quite well and was very good at his job. He essentially became a pastor of the early concealed churches in the southern Low Countries. But because he was so effective, he also had to flee a lot because his identity was always being recognized and he was being pursued left, right, and center. So he went to exile in 1548. He went to England that time. In 1552, he returned to the Low Countries. He remained there leading hidden congregations until 1555, when he was off again, this time to Lausanne and Geneva. And he got more training there. He met with some leading theologians. It's not entirely sure whether he met Calvin or not, though he undoubtedly did meet Theodore Beza. He returned to the Low Countries in 1558. In the midst of all his occupations and everything, he found time to get married, 1559. He continued serving as a pastor to concealed churches in Tournai, in Valenciennes, in other Reformed areas, until he had to go to exile once again between 63 and 66. This time he headed for the small autonomous principality of Sedan in northern France. On his return, he came back to the Church of Valenciennes, which is in the southern Low Countries, and this was now 1566-67. It was the time of really the blossoming of the Reformed faith in the Netherlands, what some people call the Wonder Year, and he was very active in this. And in Valenciennes, the Reformed started engaging in iconoclasm in the damaging of religious images in Catholic churches because the Reformed wanted to cleanse them for their worship. Not surprisingly, again, that did not give them a good reputation among the authorities. The city of Valenciennes was actually ended up being besieged for 3 months, where the troops of the governor of Margaret of Parma came to take the city back from these iconoclasts. The city authorities, together with the Reformed, blocked the gates and refused to let the troops in. After 3 months, however, the siege came to an end with a victory of the Catholic troops. Guy de Bray and another pastor, Peregrin de Lagrange, fled. Unfortunately, they were recognized. They were arrested. They were not even really put on trial because there wasn't much of a trial to be had. And they ended up both being hanged publicly in 1567. So you have a man who ends up as a martyr in 1567, and yet some 6 years before, in 1561, he wrote this confession. The early editions of the confession, here's the first one, 1561, was published actually in France, which is very interesting. It's published in Rouen, which is northwestern France. It's interesting that it's not even published in the Low Countries, but obviously there's reasons for that. It would be a risky text to try and put to a publisher in that period in the Low Countries. Now, the confession itself was intended, again, to give the Catholic authorities some idea of what it was that the Reformed believed. And particularly Guy de Bray wanted to, first of all, reassure again the authorities that they weren't rebels and dangerous people, but also wanted to distinguish the Reformed from the Anabaptists, right? Because the Anabaptists were the radical group, definitely, and the Reformed were very keen not to be confused with the Anabaptists. Catholics weren't too clear on the distinction between these various Protestant groups. They're all heretics. So Guy de Bray thought it was important to articulate his vision of what it meant to be a Christian from the Reformed perspective and to make sure you clarify that it's different from the Anabaptist viewpoint. Now, how to do this and how to get this text to the attention of the authorities was problematic because obviously you can't exactly go and hand deliver it to them. Right? You're a Protestant, you've just written a confession. You don't want to go to the Catholic leadership and say, hi, here's my confession. I mean, that's a very dangerous strategy. So Guy de Bray and his colleagues put this very interesting strategy together. They essentially packaged the confession into a bundle with two letters, an open letter to Philip II. Not that they really thought necessarily he would read it, but that's what you do, right? You write an open letter to your monarch, just like Calvin did with the first edition of the Institutes, right? The letter to Francis I, the King of France, okay? So here we have Guy de Bray with his letter to Philip II, then the confession, and then it closes with an open letter to the magistrates of the cities of the Low Countries, trying to get them to support the nascent Reformed movement. So he wrapped it all up in a package. And then he, or perhaps one of his colleagues, it's not entirely clear who, crept up to the castle of Tournai, which is where he was at the time, and threw it over the castle wall. The next morning, the guards got up and found this package and brought it into the authorities. And from there, it then actually went up the chain towards the governor, towards Margaret of Parma. So this interesting way of how to get a document into the hands of your enemies in a way that doesn't actually endanger you at the same time. Now, here is the response. So now that we have the documents of the people of the castle of Tournai who have just found this document, and what is this thing and what are they going to do with it? So here is the report that the commissioners who had been sent by Margaret of Parma sent back to her when they found this package. Madame, today at the opening of the gate of this castle, a closed and sealed package has been found, tossed within the first enclosure. This contained a lengthy writing addressed to us, or in our absence, to the authorities of the city, in the name of the resident and inhabitant burghers, containing their protests against the persecutions. They say they are not disturbing the public peace and are not rebellious against princes, and in order to make us aware of the purity of their doctrine, they present the booklet here enclosed, containing their confession, which they say more than half of this town present to us with common accord, and to which more than 100,000 people of this land agree together. So the strategy worked. The document is actually making its way back to Margaret of Parma. Other copies of the confession were discovered in December of 1561, and two more commissioners wrote about this discovery, this time reporting back to Philip II himself. Moreover, small booklets have been found, printed in the name of the faithful subjects here, addressing Your Majesty, containing their confession, full of all kinds of errors and perverse doctrine of Calvin, and at the end a remonstrance to the magistrates concerning what they are forced to endure. Therefore, it has immediately been made known everywhere that such books are not permitted in these lands, and that if someone would find copies of these, that they must be confiscated to learn where these came from, who would be the author, and where they have been printed. Nevertheless, we have not been able to know anything further about it with certainty, except that it is said to be made in France and printed in Rouen, and that these evil spirits from Geneva or France do this to mislead and incite the subjects here. End quote. So a fairly thorough report going now back to Philip II. So the confession early on was known about by the Catholic authorities. Now, obviously, it did not have the impact that Guy Debray had hoped. It wasn't like the Catholic leadership read this and thought, oh, okay then, that's fine. It did not have that effect at all. In fact, in some cases, you might think it actually misfired because it made people more concerned about these, quote, perverse doctrines that are going around. But by the end of the year of 1561, in which this confession had first appeared in French, the objective of bringing it to the attention of the authorities had worked, but again, the procedure may have backfired. But it's clear that the document was being circulated and circulating very quickly. So you have an edition in 1561 printed in Rouen. In the same year, there's another edition, also printed anonymously, this time probably in Lyon. There are two more French editions in 1562, the next year, Dutch editions in 1562, 63, 64, and 66, a first Latin translation in 1578, and the first English translation all the way down to 1645. So pretty quickly, this text is getting out there in various editions and various versions. So, just to sum up this particular section, we have a confession of faith written and published in French by a Reformed pastor. It was very closely modeled on the French Confession of Faith, what's known as the Gallican Confession of 1559. In fact, the title page is almost identical, and a lot of the wording repeats. So clearly, Guy Debray had the French Confession of Faith in front of him at the time when he was composing his. It was brought to the attention of the authorities in the Low Countries, either through raids or through deliberate delivery in a covert way. Now let's look more closely at the text itself. So let's try and see, well, what can we learn about the text? Again, if you looked at the 1561 confession, you have more than just the confession of faith. You have this letter to Philip II. There was actually a sonnet in it as well. And there were 2 pages worth of biblical quotations talking about how it's important to stand up for your faith and your beliefs. Then there was the confession itself. And then the 10-page letter to the magistrates of the Low Countries. So it's a whole package. And in some ways, when we just have the text of the confession, we've lost a lot of the context. We don't have all this other material to help make sense of what it was all about. The main focal points of the confession itself. Well, here's an issue. How long should a confession be, ideally? I mean, you think about something like, I don't know, a creed. Those are pretty short, right? Think of the Apostles' Creed. That's not very long. The Nicene Creed, a little longer. Athanasian Creed, longer yet. But confessions of faith, particularly Reformed and Protestant confession of faith of the 16th century, tend to be really quite lengthy. So the Belgic Confession is 37 articles. The French Confession of Faith had 40 articles. And even these 37 articles are fairly extensive, that the text is not short. Generally speaking, in times of doctrinal division and controversy, your confessions tend to get longer, right? Because you need to explain not only what you believe, but how what you believe is different from what somebody else believes. So it stretches out the length of the confession over time. A confession is different from a catechism. So you think about that. Let's think about this together. So you've got the Heidelberg Catechism, for instance, which is probably the best-known catechism, and then you've got the Belgic Confession. If you're comparing these two documents, what are the main things that are different about them? If you think about audience, if you think about intent, how would you distinguish the two for me? Yeah, go ahead.
Designed for young people or children, and the other, obviously, for adults and very well educated.
Okay, so you'd think the catechism is for younger people or less educated people, and generally for an internal audience, right? For an audience from within the group. You're trying to teach what are the fundamentals of the faith for the people who are part of the faith. I mean, it might have an external purpose, but that's not its primary purpose. Its primary purpose is internal. A confession can be both as a dual function, both internal and external. It says what we believe, but it also explains to other people what we believe and why our beliefs are the way they are and what the key points are and how they differ from this other group or that other group. So it has a different function. It's a different kind of text. Confessions intend to explain or clarify the beliefs of the group, and they tend to focus more, at least Reformation confessions do, on contested points of doctrine. So what do we believe and how is it different from what someone else might believe? So the Belgic Confession covers the standard kinds of things you'd expect. It covers the doctrine of God, Scripture. What books are part of the Bible? What ones are canonical? What ones are not? It talks about Trinity, about Christ, the Holy Spirit, about providence and predestination, human creation and the fall, original sin, election, salvation, justification, sanctification, the role of the law, the nature of the church, church leadership, church order, the sacraments, and the role of civil government. All this in 37 articles. The last one is the return of Christ, which is specific to the Belgic Confession. It doesn't appear in the Gallican one, for instance. The French one doesn't do that. It's interesting to compare these texts. All right, so there's our text. Now I want to talk about the key changes the text went through in its first 60 years, because these texts are not static. It's not like they remain exactly identical over time. The first 60 years of this text. Now, there's a very careful overview. If you're interested in this subject and you want to go through it in detail, there's a man called Nicholas Gutjes, and he's written a book, The Belgic Confession, Its History and Sources, published by Baker, and I can get you that information later if you want it. It's very helpful for those who want a more in-depth look about the variant editions and all the changes that took place. Now, there's a complex early history of this text, mainly because it's very quickly a bilingual history in French and in Dutch. And the two versions are not in sync. So the first Dutch translation was based on the first French edition, which kind of makes sense. But then the French edition was changed, and the Dutch edition didn't keep up. The Dutch edition continued to be based on the first French one for the longest time, so they're out of step. So the two versions are not actually identical in those first 60 years. So the French edition was updated more quickly, the Dutch edition more slowly. The French text was revised most significantly in 1566. So 5 years after it was written, it's revised fairly significantly at the Synod of Antwerp. And already in 1566, the text has changed in its appearance quite drastically, because now in 1566, you only have the confession. You don't have the letter to Philip II. You don't have the letter to the magistrates. The sonnet is gone. And those biblical references that were at the start of the text, those are dropped as well. The Dutch edition was based on the first French edition up until 1583, when it caught up. So in 1583, the Dutch said, hang on, we're out of step. Let's get that more recent French edition and base our translation off of that. So things are not in step and in sequence. The key changes. Well, what changes took place? In 1566, a lot of what happened at first is a lot of cleaning up of the text. So words are changed, some things are deleted, some things are added, but it's intended to help the flow of the text. So in terms of, are these structural changes, are these small changes? In many cases, they are small changes. There's changes in wording, changes to make the thing more readable. But there are some substantive changes that took place in 1566. So, for instance, Article 16 in 1561 said, it was talking about election. The original text said, so it was talking about election, those who are elected by Christ, and then it said, leaving the others in their ruin and fall into which they had stumbled. So talking about those who are not elected. Leaving the others in the ruin and fall into which they had stumbled. The 1566 revised version said, leaving the others in their ruin and fall into which they rushed headlong. Which is different, okay? Stumbling is one thing. Rushing headlong indicates purpose, okay? So now when you're talking about election, this is significant, okay? Because it's essentially imputing the fault of being lost on the people who were not among the elect. So the revised version had a greater sense of the active role of human beings in their own fall. Changes in 1566 also happened in Article 36. Article 36 is the one you're going to hear a lot about because that's the one on civil government that was the biggest point of contention all the way along. In 1566, in the Article 36 on the role of civil government, the original text had referred to, quote, those who want to reject their superiors and magistrates. In 1566, this was changed to specifically name the Anabaptists among those who would want to reject their superiors and magistrates. So the blame of the Anabaptists actually occurs in 1566. Guy de Bray had not named the Anabaptists specifically right there. There's a rewording of the part of the article that dealt with the role of the government in the church, and this is really one of the most complicated parts. The original text said that the government's role included, quote, to restrain and watch over both political and religious matters, end quote. So restrain and watch over political and religious matters. 1566 version said, quote, to take care and watch over civil matters, but also maintain the holy ministry. Okay, that's a lot more active. That's saying that the government is going to maintain the holy ministry, is going to take an active role in supporting the Reformed faith and its church. So in 1566, the political situation had changed, right? The Reformed are in their wonder year. They're hoping for much more power. They're hoping for an alliance with the magistrates, and therefore the confession reflects that, where Guy de Bray did not really have that hope in 1561 amid a greater time of persecution. Now, the Synod of Dort that met from 1618 to 1619 also paid a lot of attention to the Belgic Confession, and they did it in a number of ways. There'd been a lot of questions running up to the Synod of Dort, particularly from Arminians who weren't exactly sure that the Belgic Confession said things as it should or that it should be fully normative or compulsory for everybody to sign up to. The Synod of Dort decided, no, we really need to get this nailed down. And of course, they had a lot of international delegates at the Synod of Dort, right? They had delegates from England and from Scotland and from Geneva. So they got everyone together in one of the sessions towards the end, all the international delegates, they gathered them together and they asked them to judge whether the text of the confession was in conformity with the Reformed faith. And the international delegate said, yes, it was. Now, they still had points of disagreement, right? The English delegates were not so keen on this business of the equality in the church among all pastors, because, of course, the English church was much more hierarchical. But beyond that, they were willing to say, yes, this reflects the Reformed faith. It does not teach anything against the Reformed faith. We're all good with that. Then all the international delegates went home, and then the Synod of Dort had all the Dutch delegates work on revising the text. It's kind of an interesting way of proceeding, right? Because then the international delegates had approved the substance, but the wording changed after they went home. The Dutch delegates who remained worked on revisions of the French and the Dutch texts, both of them together, and both of them were officially approved by these Dutch delegates at the end of the Synod. And these are word changes, clarifications, additions. They spell things out much more. So when the original text had listed the five books of Moses, well, now the Synod of Dort names the five books of Moses. The four books of Kings, they name what these books are. So they spell things out much more. Interestingly, what the Synod of Dort also did was to remove all the biblical references that had been in the margins up until this point. They removed them all. Now, that was an interesting idea. The problem there was they did not want to get into contentions with people as to whether this Bible verse really said what it's supposed to say and did it really support this part of the confession or not. They just deleted them all, removed them totally. The French and Dutch versions approved at the Synod of Dort are then the normative versions. However, the two versions are not 100% identical, which is interesting. Translation is an art form. It's not a science, okay? It doesn't work mathematically. You do this and you do that, and it's exactly the same. The two versions are not 100% identical. So you think, okay, now we've had the history of the changes. Do these changes matter? In a sense, you think, well, okay, they changed some wording here and there, and I can see that it might make a bit of a difference. But in some ways, is this just small potatoes? Does it really matter? There are two reasons why the changes of the text have made a difference on how people view this confession, in fact, all confessional documents. The first reason, if you start changing language, you can get into debate as to which version is the right version, right? Is it the original version? Is it the one that Guy de Bray penned back in 1561? Or is it the version that the Synod of Antwerp worked on in 1566? Or is it the one that the Synod of Dort worked on? Which one is the true version? Which one is the authoritative version? As soon as you start changing text, that debate opens up. That's very clear that that would happen. Now, you could say, well, the original author's version is the most important one because that was the original author. It has all that weight of the person who wrote it. And, of course, he's a martyr, so we've got that kind of emphasis there, too. Or you could say, well, you know what? A synod is a gathering of lots of people all putting their best minds to it, and that would be the better version. And, of course, you could say, well, the synod was possibly inspired by the Holy Spirit, and, of course, they would come up with the best version. So you can have these debates about which version is more authoritative. Those of you who've been in a lot of committee meetings may wonder which one would be best. The other question, the other issue that arises once changes are made to a text is the question that strikes people as deeply problematic. Can a confession be changed? Is it okay to change the wording of a confession? In other words, if you start altering the text of the confession, are you essentially implying that this thing is fallible, that it has errors in it, that it is not, in fact, 100% fully valid for all time? Now, no one in these debates was saying that the Belgic confession is equivalent to Scripture, you know, that it has the weight of the Bible or anything like that, but the confessions do carry authority in a particular way. They're a particular kind of text, and therefore the debate over changes and the impact of changes is a significant one. And we're going to come back to this question of the authority of the confessions. All right, questions about reception. The Belgic confession became authoritative relatively quickly. Now, we don't know all the details because not all the records of the synods have survived. Especially the early synods in the 1560s when there was persecution, we don't have the records of those synods. Those records have been lost. But I can give you some markers, some signs of what was happening with this confession in its first 60 years. So, at the synod, the provincial synod of Armentières in 1563, the Belgic confession is referred to as, quote, the confession of faith adopted among us, which is already saying that it has some kind of authority. At the Synod of Antwerp in 1565, a decision was made to read out the confession at the start of each synod meeting. Again, that carries weight, and that's what the French did with the Gallican confession. They would read it at the start of every single synod meeting. The Synod of Antwerp in 1566 oversaw the revisions of the French text. The Synod of Emden, meeting in exile in 1571, said, quote, to testify to the agreement in doctrine within the Dutch churches, it was resolved by the brothers to subscribe to the confession of the Dutch churches. In other words, now everybody has to sign to it. They have to agree to it. At the Synod of Dort in 1578, elders have to sign up to the Belgic confession as well as pastors, but interestingly not deacons, just elders and pastors. At the Synod of Middelburg in 1581, quote, the ministers of the word, elders and deacons, and also the professors of theology, which is also proper for the other professors and the school teachers, shall subscribe to the confession of faith of the Dutch churches. Okay, now we're really broadening it. Pastors, elders, deacons, professors, and school teachers. Everybody has to sign up. At the Synod of The Hague in 1586, quote, it is also desired that from now on the 37 articles mentioned before are not only printed uniformly without additions or deletions, again, this question about the changing of the text, but are also subscribed to by all who serve in churches and schools for the maintaining of pure doctrine against all sects. So, if you wanted to wonder how far back does it go that people who teach have to subscribe to the confession, guess what? It's already all the way back into the 1570s and 1580s. Now, clearly this was a process. It did not happen everywhere at the same pace, and over time, it looks like there was more and more concern for doctrinal uniformity in the Low Countries, in the Dutch provinces in particular. Now, that's an important question of its own, and this is because by the 1570s and 1580s, while the seven northern provinces had split from the southern ones, declared their independence, and made Calvinism, the Reformed faith, the state faith, that did not mean that everybody in the Netherlands was now Reformed. In fact, It's a very much a minority faith in terms of those who practice it and hold to it. So what you're getting, I think, is a sense among the Reformed of a somewhat of an anxiety that they are living really in a confessionally plural world where there are Lutherans and Catholics and Anabaptists. And so now we need to have something that unifies the Reformed, and we're going to do that by holding to this confession. And now the text in context. Why did the Belgic Confession gain traction? Well, that's an interesting question, because technically the Reformed in the Low Countries could have picked something else, right? Those who spoke French could have gone for the Gallican Confession, the French Confession. Why not? There's no reason why not. Linguistically, they could have done it. They could have translated that one into Dutch and used that. Or maybe they would have liked the Scots Confession of 1560, right in the same time period. Why not pick that one? It's clear that the Belgic Confession was benefited from the early adoption done by a lot of the provincial and more national synods of the Low Countries. And the fact that the text was written by someone who was later martyred also carried a lot of weight. So you've got these two factors coming together. But again, we mustn't take it sort of start from the end and work back to the beginning. Even in the 1580s, not everybody knew what this Belgic Confession was all about. So, for instance, some of the delegates at the 1581 Synod of Middelburg said, quote, "What is this confession of 37 articles?" So they don't know about it. So it's not the case that everyone everywhere took it up and said, yes, this is what we believe, and we're all good, and we're all behind it. That's not historically accurate. Okay, the Belgic Confession in the CRC. The Belgic Confession is one of the three doctrinal standards of the denomination. And by the early 20th century, there was interest in the denomination in getting a version in English. So, okay, what happens? Well, then Synod puts together a translation committee. You want to get it in English, you put a translation committee together. The first problem is, well, what text should you use to translate into English? Should you use the version of the Synod of Dort from 1619? Should you go back to the 1561 version? And, you know, there's all the variants. What do you do with those? How do you handle that? And what should you do with Article 36? Because Article 36, the one on church and state, had, in its rephrasing from the time of 1566 and through the canons of Dort, really articulated essentially a state church. Now, in the situation of the CRC in North America in the early 20th century, that didn't really fit, right? The separation of church and state, you've got all these people who have left the Netherlands, left the state church, and yet the Belgic Confession seems to advocate a state church. What do you do in those circumstances? Difficult problem to handle. And what should you do about the critiques of the Anabaptists? Okay, the Belgic Confession is pretty specific, critical of the Anabaptists in Articles 18, 34, and 36. Do you just leave them? Do you change them? Well, the English Translation Committee was appointed by the Synod in 1906. By 1912, 6 years later, that's pretty good, there an English translation is approved with the addition of a footnote in Article 36 explaining the importance of religious freedom. So they leave the text the way it was with church and state, but in the footnote it says, but, you know, religious freedom is kind of really important. Okay, so they try and do a little bit of both. In 1938, the Synod went ahead and changed the text of Article 36. Rather than living with the text and the footnote that don't seem to fit, they just go ahead and change the text of Article 36, and they rephrase it to take it away from that state church model. They change the language pretty clearly to get away from the state church side of things. In 1977, Synod struck a committee to prepare a new English translation of the Belgic Confession, and this one reintegrated a lot of the biblical references that had dropped out at the canon of, at the Synod of Dort. And by 1982, so we're still working on it, and by 1982, the committee majority report was in favor of using the authorized version from the canons of Dort. The minority report advocated using the 1561 text. So there wasn't a whole lot of agreement there between those two sides. However, the 1619 text did win out. The new translation was adopted by Synod in 1985 after footnoting the rejection of the Anabaptists of Article 36. So the critiques of the Anabaptists in Article 36, at least one of the two critiques. There's two critiques in the same article. One of them is dropped to a footnote. The other one remains. The critiques of the Anabaptists in Article 18 and 24 are still there. They haven't taken those out. They haven't footnoted them. They're just right there. So, what is then the role of confessional documents today? Well, let's have a little poll here. How frequently do you hear anything about or read from the Belgic Confession in a ordinary church service? Raise your hand if you have had, within the last month, anything where you've read responsively of the Belgic Confession or someone's preached on it. Any hands? Oy, all right. Certain people, it's the case. But for most people, not so much. In fact, you hear more about the Heidelberg Catechism than you do about the Belgic Confession by a long shot. It's kind of interesting that that's the case. Should more attention be paid to the Belgic Confession? That's already an interesting question. And if so, how could that be done effectively? How do you make a text like that accessible, interesting, relevant to people in the 21st century? What role do confessional documents play in our churches in the 21st century? And, of course, here in our college, too. You hear words used when you talk about the confession. Some people talk about guardrails, or fences, or borders, or parameters, or guidelines. It's very interesting language when we talk about the confessions. What is their purpose? Framework. These words come up again and again. Now, on my part, I would push for a much more thorough understanding of the historical context in which this document and the other doctrinal standards emerged. Because I think by understanding the historical context, you understand a whole lot more about the document. You know, if you read the Belgic Confession, now knowing about its context, it's amazing how little critique of Catholicism there is in the Belgic Confession. You'd think that given Guy Debray is a persecuted Reformed Christian, that he would put in much more about the problems of the Catholic Church and why they're against it and so on. He really doesn't. It's actually very interesting. The Gallican Confession is much more anti-Catholic than the Belgic Confession was. And I think we understand that by knowing that Guy Debray was in the moderate faction, trying to have the Reformed faith grow without being totally wiped out by persecution. And that means that when you're proposing your ideas to your adversaries, you don't slam your adversaries because that doesn't really help you gain any kind of a listening ear. Now, what do we do with this text? Where do we go from here? Are there any suggestions? I think, again, knowing the history of the doctrinal standards helps. Knowing how the documents come into being, understanding and reading the text themselves helps. Understanding that these are human documents, I think, is very important. I don't think we want to give more weight to the confessions than they can really bear. These are human-crafted documents. They have a human history. Now, that does not detract from their status as a confessional document. It doesn't mean that we're underplaying them, but we have to understand their context more genuinely in order really to give them the place that they really should hold. Understanding that context can also help us make better and more informed decisions and have better discussions when it comes to considering the potential status of other documents in the denomination, such as, for instance, the Belhar Confession. Unless you understand more about the history and the nature of the confessional documents we already have, it's not very easy to have a good discussion about potential documents that we may want to bring in as confessions or statements or however else we want to make it. Any kind of approach wants to be taken. But I think really this 450th anniversary of the Belgic Confession gives us a chance to reflect a little more about these documents and about their purpose. And I will stop here and open it for discussion. Thank you. All right, questions, comments, things you've always wanted to ask. Irene. Okay, the name comes from the southern. Now, it's a name given because of the Latin name for the southern area of what was the Low Countries, which then obviously later became Belgian. Like Gallican is a funny word too, and it's again from Gaul, okay, so the name of the old name for France. It's not a very helpful name in some ways, but that's the name it seems to have gotten and is stuck with. And the same with Guy de Bray. You see his name as Guido, you see the spelling of de Bray in different ways. It's the fact of being this sort of bilingual document in two different contexts that changes a lot of the names and gives it these kinds of labels. Other questions? Paul.
The Guy de Bray, it sounds like from what you said, he definitely was trying to be conciliatory.
Mm-hmm.
So the letter clearly wasn't an in-your-face pun to the wall.
Exactly.
Now, it looks like when you had the two accompanying letters from the people who discovered these documents,
yes,
one of them seemed somewhat conciliatory.
Yes.
This seems reasonable enough.
Yep.
I won't actually take a stand to say it so, but
yes,
I'll repeat the things that are nice there. And the other one was like, this...
Terrible. I think that's very clearly dependent on who the letter was addressed to.
Okay.
So the first one is going to Margaret of Parma, who's the governor, and actually found herself in a very sticky situation and ended up being perceived, at least for a while, as possibly more tolerant. And the other one is going to Philip II. You would not want to write to Philip II the first letter and say, this is what they're saying. And so, if Philip II is your master, you're going to be pretty clearly strongly anti-Catholic in order to retain your post. Because if you're not, you could be fired very quickly. I think so. And if you say... Yeah, if you say to Philip II, this document says this and this and this and these are good things, if you don't say strong things against this document, then you may be tarred with the same brush, and that would be very dangerous. So partly the men he hires are going to be people who share his sympathies, partly also they don't want to upset their master, and they're going to say these kind of things.
Who the person is and who they're...
The recipient. The recipient is very important. Correct. Questions in the back. Harry.
The brain being a moderate.
Yes.
And what's his role in the iconoclast problem?
He tried to prevent it. He really did not think that was good. He was not in favor of the public psalm singing. He was not in favor of the rescuing of prisoners. He was not in favor of the iconoclasm because he said this is just wrecking our position, basically. Now, once Valenciennes had locked its doors to the government troops, there's not much he could do about it. I mean, he's really stuck with that, and that's the position he's going to be in. But he was publicly not in favor of this kind of move of the reform to get more public in their presentation of their faith and to do stuff that could be perceived as, and was perceived as, very damaging to their own cause. So he was against the iconoclasm. Yeah. Questions here? Otherwise, other ones? Okay, yes. Go ahead.
Yes.
George.
You mentioned our current translation is based on the version from the Synod of Dort. But you said there were two Synod of Dort.
Yes.
They're not
significant differences. I do not know which one they picked. At a first guess, I would have said the Dutch, but I don't want to say offhand to say that that might not be right. And the best sense would be if they'd conferred the two, but I don't know if they did. And that would be my understanding. John, did you have a question?
Yeah. One of the interesting things to think about lately is the difference between many Presbyterian denominations and many of the Dutch Reformed tradition. Professions play a role for all members.
Yes.
It comes in the profession of faith form. So it's not true for most Presbyterians, but it has been true in most Dutch Reformed traditions that at profession of faith, people are asked, do you agree with the Word of God and that the confessions and teachings of this church agree?
Yes.
So do you have a sense of how far back that use?
I would have to look into that. That's an interesting question. I don't know the answer. I would expect... No, I don't know the answer. I don't want to say for fear that I don't have it right. So I would have to look into that because the whole history of profession of faith is an interesting one on its own. And the way we do it today, I think, would be quite different from how it would be done. Certainly, if you were a young person in Geneva in the 16th century, they did not ask you at your what would be a profession of faith to say that you believe in the Bible and that the confessions stand up for it. What you have to do is recite what's called the sum of the catechism and show that you know the fundamentals of your faith, and then you can participate in the Lord's Supper. So we'd have to look back into the history of the way we do profession of faith and see how far back that goes for the order saying what it does. Good question, though. Yes?
I don't know if this is a indication of what the vacillating attitude of the Christian Reformed Church is toward the confessions, but I couldn't help but notice that in the 1934 Psalter Hymnal, they have the courage to say that the original was anti-biblical, was unbiblical.
Interesting.
Then in the Blue Psalter Hymnal, that phraseology disappeared.
So we're talking about Article 36, that they said Article 36 was unbiblical. Yes. 36. Yes.
And then in the Gray Psalter, it comes back again.
Yes.
That indicates vacillating on our part, but
you know, it's such a difficult one to deal with because that whole, the way it was stated fitted the context of the late 16th century very well, and the early 17th century very well. You want the government to support the churches and repress the idolaters and those who believe differently. You really want that. But then in the context of the 19th century, the 20th century, and the 21st century, what do you do with that when it's a very different model?
I'm much more in step with the blue version than the red and the gray.
Okay.
We've come back so hard and said that's anti, that's unbiblical.
Yeah.
I feel uncomfortable with that.
Yeah, I mean, again, there's so much debate, and you can go up in Heckman Library and pull out all these works that were written, you know, for and against Article 36, and it goes on and on and on. So it's clearly still something that people were very much debating as to how to handle that properly and what to do with. I mean, what do you do with something in the confession that you now think is not right? Do you just quietly delete it? Do you reword it? What? How do you do that? That's a tricky, tricky thing. Yes, sir.
In Article 37, there's some wording, something like, you know, that God sends fire.
Yes.
In order to cleanse this whole world.
Yes.
That a purposeful contrast to Anabaptist
thinking? That's a good question, and I would have to look at that. Let me look back and see what I can find for that, and we'll figure out a way to let you know. How about that? Because I don't know for sure, but the points at which they combated the Anabaptists otherwise, you know, and named them, was obviously the article on baptism. That's where you clearly expect it. And then there's a part on the dual nature of Christ and his being born of Mary in human flesh, and it says, which the Anabaptists don't believe. And that one sort of I'm still kind of flummoxed by. I've got to look back and try and figure out why it was that Guy Debray or others thought that the Anabaptists thought that Jesus was not, because that, as far as I know, is not an Anabaptist teaching. But they certainly got it from somewhere. So we'll look into that. Other questions? Yes, Jamie.
I'm not quite sure what follows from pointing out the humanness of the document, because I don't think we have any documents that aren't human.
Well,
they're not as authoritative because they were thought to be divine.
No.
By the community of faith. Well,
yeah, here's the thing. We give these documents a particular standing, different from just somebody's thoughts on what they might believe, say. In doing so, and in the fact that these are humanly authored documents, we basically take an authority on something that was written at a specific time and a specific place, and we make it almost timeless in a weird way.
Do we have any documents that weren't written at a particular time in a particular place, but nonetheless are reported trans-temporal authority? So, for instance, everything you're claiming about the humanness of the confession also holds for the Nicene Creed and also holds for Paul's letters to the Romans. So, I just think humanness is a category mistake.
Yeah.
For raising questions about transtemporal authority.
Yeah. I think we. There's a sense in which the way in which we look at the confessions gives them weight that I'm not sure that they should necessarily bear. I'm trying to articulate that.
Itself already undercuts its weight vis-a-vis the scriptures.
Yes.
So the internal to the confessions themselves is already an understanding of a certain relativity.
Correct.
On the other hand, they articulate as authorities relative to the scriptures, relative to the creeds, and so on. So I think you have all the resources internal to the confession to get the kind of relative authority that you want. I just don't see how invoking humanist does any work that wouldn't also wash over onto Nicaea, Chalcedon, and the scriptures.
Yeah, I think you would find a debate with some people about the nature of Scripture versus, you know, the nature of the confessions. Yeah, but that's one where, I mean, I'm not a biblical scholar, and I can't, you know, debate that one, clearly. But what I wanted to try and articulate, I think, is the same problem we have sometimes, and this is a different status, but the same kinds of problems emerge. There are people who really, really, really admire the writings of John Calvin, and they want to make it normative for all times and all places. And we have books and books and books in the Meter Center on Calvin and whatever topic you want. And it's like Calvin's pronouncement is somehow authoritative. Now, that's a different thing, again, from a confession, because it doesn't have the body, you know, working on that. But I find that, again, rather troubling, that we would do that, that we would put so much weight on these words and take them out of context in that way. And that's really what I was trying to get at. All right. Yes.
Anniversary year, no doubt there are articles in the Reformed and Presbyterian Press. Are there some articles that you could recommend?
On the Belgic Confession, that's going to be interesting. And we have these, obviously, in our sites for our bibliographies and so on. Most of them will probably appear next year, because what you do is you do the anniversary first, and then you write about it. So I suspect we will have more information for you in the spring or even next fall on what's being written. For instance, conferences that have been held and publications as a result of that and so on and so forth. Although I can't say that I've seen a whole lot of advertising for great gatherings to mark the 450th of the Belgic Confession. Maybe 450 is not such a big number. I don't know. Yes?
Following up on your comments with regard to the Belhar,
yes.
I'm curious with regard to how you might apply that to the contemporary testimony.
Yeah.
As a member of the, for the last 3 years, of the former subscription committee renewal,
yes.
Or revision, we struggled many hours with what to do with the contemporary testimony.
Yes.
We included it in there.
Yep.
Within that, internally, it's not a confession.
Yep.
And when it was adopted in the 1980s, now we had a revision, there was, I think, interest in making it a confession, but also a real resistance to it.
Yes.
Partly because, well, you've got to keep the other sacrosanct.
Yes.
And this is something different. And how can we be so,
yep.
so forward to introduce another confession, which mm-hmm. I think is part of the argument with the Belhar confession as well.
Exactly.
So, can you comment on that? In this case, especially with regard to contemporary testimony, which is an attempt to
yep.
make a modern confession?
Yep. You know what? I think that is such an important question, and I don't think we have a good way of talking about it, because it's, and I've been reading a lot of the stuff coming up on whether the Belhar confession should be accepted or not, and the same kinds of issues turn up where people say, well, you know, this is so grounded in a particular time and place, and it's a particular issue, and it's not, you know, it's not arising to the status of the confession. I would like to know what. You know, these things aren't weighed the same way somehow. And it seems like because the Belgic Confession is 450 years old, it carries a lot of weight even just by virtue of its longevity. So maybe the contemporary testimony and the Belhar Confession just have to wait more years before they can become. I don't know if it's their newness that's the problem, or the fact that somehow by accepting them, we somehow downgrade the others. I'm not sure I follow that logic, but that seems to be part of what it is. We can't have too many, like your love can't be shared among all your children or something. I don't know. It just strikes me as somewhat an odd kind of logic. But and the fact of being in a particular time and place for Belhar, certainly, I mean, once you know the particular time and place of the Belgic Confession, then the logic has to be the same for both. You can't have one logic for one group and one logic for another. So I know the problem. I don't know how to really articulate very clearly a response to those who feel that these are documents of a different kind. Let's see. Paul.
I'm just reflecting on the fact that this is a longer confession than
mm-hmm.
the apostolic
mm-hmm.
and so on. And it strikes me that the mention of the printing press has to have something to do with it, that you can
can now be longer, if you will.
Yes. Although, very interestingly, in the 1580s, for some reason, they were having a really hard time getting printed copies of the Belgic Confession, and they have manuscript copies circulating, and beautiful manuscript copies, and that's what all the pastors were signing, was a manuscript copy for a long time. So I think that, you might say, well, it's due to the ease of printing it, but at times they have problems printing the thing, and they go back to handwriting. So it's kind of interesting. You can still do that.
And going along the brevity, though rarely have we used the Belgian Confession worship, the Apostolic Creed is used for the virtue of brevity.
Exactly.
I think perhaps one of the resistances to the Belgian Confession is that we have a fairly expansive thing we don't even use right now.
Mm-hmm.
If we add something else, what does it truly add?
Yeah, that's part of the discussion.
And then being specific about that.
It's certainly part of the discussion. Yeah, and I think there would be people who say very strongly that it adds some very important statements about the need for justice and the need for reconciliation and God's action in the world. But I think Jim DeYoung had a question. Yes?
I really appreciated you giving the historical context because I think you're absolutely right. You can't understand these documents in abstraction from their historical setting.
Mm.
And I think that bears on the issue of nomenclature for the Belhar.
Mm-hmm.
We don't call 16th and 17th century confessions creeds.
Mm-hmm.
We reserve that term for the genre of the 4th and 5th centuries and 6th centuries because it was a different context.
Yes.
And I think instinctively, we have to this point resisted giving the term confession to 19th and 20th century statements because they're not cast in the political framework that the 17th and 18th century confessions were.
Mm.
We talk about testimonies or declarations or covenants.
Mm-hmm.
We reserve that term confession for those 17th and 16th and 17th century statements.
Yep.
And that's an issue that I haven't really heard surfaced and fleshed out.
Yep. I think that's an important point.
See where the Synod comes down on that, whether they give that the attention that it deserves.
Yeah, that's a good point. George?
But isn't the Belhar, in its historical situation of the writing of it, that came out of a very definite historical and political church historical, or church political and nation-state political context of oppressed people standing up for their rights and appealing to church authorities and political authorities for their rights. So in a sense, that is a similar historical situation to the Belgian Confession.
And particularly if we put the letters to Philip II and the magistrates back in. Which would certainly be good in terms of liminal pieces to go with it.
So was the Barman Declaration of the 1930s.
Yep.
But that's a declaration. That's not, that's not a confession.
Yes. Suzanne.
Yeah, and I mean, playing into this very much also, but it seems to me the question of genre. And on the whole, while context is hugely significant for all of those things, one thing a confession generally seeks to do is give a touch on the full breadth.
Yes.
Christian belief, or something like the Barman Declaration. It's focused on particular and specific issues. So I think that's part of the debate swirling around the Belhar as well. Do we call it a confession, given that its focus is rather narrow than generally we would understand the confession?
Mm-hmm. So then the question is also, again, what weight do we give to the words? You know, if confession is like a special status and that's what you want to achieve, is it maybe that the words we're using that are not really the helpful words? Is there another word that we could use that would say the same? I mean, are we debating over terms or are we debating over status or is it all kind of intertwined? That's the difficult part. All right, you've done really well. Thank you so much. Help yourself to more refreshments. Thank you. Before you go, one quick announcement. In the spring, in March, we're going to be celebrating the Meter Center's 30th anniversary. Now, that's not the 450th, obviously, but the 30th anniversary of the Meter Center is still a big deal. And we will be advertising all the various events that will take place. We're going to have 2 days of festivities in the Meter Center to which everyone will be most cordially invited. Thank you.